This episode is brought to you in part by Growth Collective, the creative first agency specializing in Shopify stores. With rising costs in e-commerce, higher goods prices, increasing shipping rates, and soaring ad expenses, it can be tough to profit. Today, I want you to meet Growth Collective, a creative first agency that has an enviable track record with brands like BombTech Golf, Hush Blankets, CrossNet, Firebelly Tea, and more. By focusing on crafting beautiful ads that resonate with your customer, they not only manage to make advertising profitable for their clients, but actually scale them too. Here's the best part. Growth Collective is extending an exclusive offer to you, our listeners. Get an in-depth audit of your ad account absolutely free. They'll help you uncover new account structures to give you more consistency in your account. And they'll not only study your brand, but your competitors as well, to give you dozens of new creative ideas that'll actually drive your customer acquisition costs down, helping you scale. So if you're feeling stuck with your current team, visit wearegrowth.co and mention Unofficial Shopify for unlocking your true store's potential. Today on the Unofficial Shopify podcast, we are going to discuss Drew Sinaki's, I had to write this one down. Big Busted Brand Turnaround Playbook, right? That's not what he calls it, but that's what I'm going with, because Drew has 20 years of e-commerce experience doing just that, turning brands around, scaling brands, growing e-commerce businesses. And we had him on the past to talk about his experience in e-com and in leadership and what he learned. And that was a fan favorite. I got a lot of positive feedback about that. So when I saw in a recent newsletter, which he calls the Drew's Letter, that I always think is funny, he was sharing some of his lessons. I thought, you know what? It is time to bring this gentleman back. I want to hear what he thinks about brand turnarounds, what he could teach us about efficiently scaling an e-commerce business. And, you know, let's pick his brain on that 20 years of experience. So, Mr. Drew Sinaki, welcome back. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Kurt.
What are you working on these days?
I'm working on today. I'm not doing as many turnarounds. I'm not doing any, actually. I'm doing Postpilot, which is a software company. We do direct mail for e-commerce. So if you haven't done direct mail, check us out. But yeah, my turnaround days, I don't know if they're behind me, but they're on pause right now. I haven't done a turnaround in a couple of years.
Postpilot, and now's the time where I must disclose, I invested in Postpilot, and I'm proud to have done so. Such an interesting and different tactic. What does Postpilot do?
Postpilot unlocks direct mail for e-commerce brands. We make direct mail fast and easy. So unlocks a new profitable channel. You can use direct mail for retention, retargeting, and prospecting, and it's works really well. It's really relevant now as people are struggling with Meta and other channels. So check us out, postpilot.com.
And all right, let's go back here. So doing e-commerce 20 years, you said, and not do a turnaround, like then you were doing turnarounds. You said not anymore. You're doing running Postpilot. Like looking back on it, do you think there's any like key pivotal turning points, moments in that career that got you to where you are today? You know, one or two things.
I don't think I could have done what I'm doing today at Postpilot without having run this turnaround gauntlet in the past. Because I think I got, it's more than turnarounds. It's just how to get a business profitable really quickly. So, I mean, if you're already profitable, I think the same lessons are relevant. It's just how to get more profitable quickly. And that just the lessons that came out of three or four turnarounds, like running a lean team, being very entrepreneurial, being scrappy, driving revenue, cutting costs. Like those things are all, that's sort of the mentality that we brought to Postpilot. I mean, Postpilot wasn't a turnaround, but we did acquire that business and put a team in place. And we've been profitable since we started it.
How'd you get involved in e-commerce? Because you got in early.
I got in early. Like I started my first brand in 2000, maybe even 99. Yeah, not 2000. I've lived through three recessions, I think, at this point during my professional career. So one was the dot-com bust, which was 2000. So I graduated from business school. At that point, everybody was going to dot-com 1.0, like pets.com, iVillage. I don't even know if these things exist anymore. eBay. We all graduate, and 6 months after graduation, everybody's unemployed because there's this recession, dot-com bust. And I just went to the library. I picked, there was nothing, there was no Shopify, there was no podcasts on e-commerce. I got a book out on, you know, building a website, and I built a website in Dreamweaver, and I basically started what became dropshipping. I was like, I can just put a store together. I want to learn about furniture because maybe I'm going to start a furniture brand at some point. And I'm just going to throw a site up. And I didn't see this happening, but at the same time, like, Google had come out and like long tail search was a thing. And AdWords came out maybe a year or two, you know, but basically around the same time. So all of a sudden there was this opportunity to optimize the long tail of products for terms like, you know, Eames Lounge or Blue Dot Bed. And we just did a really good job of that. The business took off. We sort of tabled the idea of starting our own furniture brand, and we went with it. That was Design Public, started in 2000 and sold that about 10 years later.
Not bad.
Yeah, and then that started my career in turnarounds because we sold to a private investment group. And then I got married and had kids around there and really wanted, you know, your risk return appetite sort of changes, or your calculus changes. And at the time, I started working more and more with private equity. And I knew I didn't want to work 7 days a week, like bootstrapping something myself. Private equity was interesting because, you know, they would buy a property and they'd bring me in to help turn it around and or find the opportunities, and it paid well. And so that became my career for the next, I don't know, my turnaround career was about another 10 years after that.
And so how many, if you had to estimate, how many brands do you think you've been involved with?
Probably like 10 to 20, but involved is, it's different. You know, when you work in private equity, sometimes it's, you do a lot of diligence on a deal, you see an opportunity, and a lot of the work you're doing without even interacting really with the company, you're trying to figure out where the opportunities are, how you'd grow it. And you know, 9 times out of 10, the deal doesn't go through or someone else outbids you. So that work is for naught. In other cases, the deal does go through. Auto Anything is probably the most recent example that you know of, Kurt, where, you know, we ended up getting that property. We did all the work ahead of time. We ended up getting the property, and then I sort of go operational. And in that case, I became the CEO of that company and worked on the turnaround for a few years.
And where'd that end up?
That one, it's like we did well until we didn't. I think the business was doing really well. We did, I would say we turned it around. We got it profitable again and growing. We acquired 3 or 4 different properties. Kind of we were doing a roll up before Thrasio, just like within the category. It was working really well. We had these great plans to bring private label, sort of like that was the next step. We had this huge audience of automotive enthusiasts who were going to introduce private label. But then COVID hit and really cut out the supply chain for the whole category. Like, you couldn't get automotive gear for.
Yeah, everybody had their supply chain problems, but like aftermarket automotive got hit harder.
Oh yeah, especially hard. I mean, and you would read about it in the Wall Street Journal. It was not just us. It was GM and Ford and all the big companies too. So at the end of the day, we sold that asset off. But it wasn't the huge win that we all thought we were in for in the early days.
You know, no one could have, best laid plans, no one could have predicted the pandemic and then the resulting supply chain issues. No. So from your experience here, what are a couple of the common missteps that can lead brands into, say, financial trouble?
Yeah, I mean, it's really like they have too high a cost structure and they're not making enough money. You know, it's pretty like it's revenue and costs. And I think D2C gets in this situation, and one of the biggest costs for D2C is customer acquisition costs, where they lose track of like low cost sources of new customers. They get mature, they staff up across the business. Often they're too heavy. They have legacy. I would say most of the turnarounds I've dealt with have a legacy tech stack, and they're not only the costs of maintaining this tech stack, but the direct cost, the software cost, but there's the personnel cost. AutoAnything had something like 10 to 15 engineers on staff just maintaining the website. I think it was a $100 million revenue brand, but still today you could put the whole thing on Shopify or BigCommerce or something off the shelf and say, take a lot of costs out of the business. So you see that a lot with these brands that were sort of built, or they came out of like the early 2000s, because it was pre-Shopify, pre-Magento, pre-off the shelf. Everything's custom, and they have a lot of the big bloated tech stack.
A bloated tech stack, additional staffing, that's going to increase expense. And you said, like, fundamentally, that is the issue here, is expense outstripping our revenue. When you start looking at those expenses in a business, how do you deal with it? How do you decide, like, this is what goes?
Yeah, that's tough, because a lot of it has to be done before you acquire the business. So there's a bit of like the outside looking in, trying to figure this out. The problem is, if you take over the business and then try to figure it out, it's almost too late. You know, like, you'd rather hit the ground running, have your cost cuts in place often before you take over the business, certainly within the first few months. And it's, I find that the wrong way to do it is to look at what's there and start figuring that you're going to take maybe 10% out of a department, out of every department, you know, just sort of that like incremental approach is not, it doesn't always work. I think what's better is to take a blank whiteboard and say, like, how would I build this business from the ground up today? Because you really need to rethink things like AutoAnything today. How would I build that from the ground up? Okay, it's on Shopify. How many people do I need to maintain this? You know, the catalog, how are we going to update the catalog? What system do we need there? How many do we need in marketing? It's almost like you build your perfect team, and then you look at what they have now and say, okay, like, how am I going to get from here to there? So that exercise, I think, is a lot easier and usually more fruitful than just sort of like an incremental approach. Like, okay, take 10% off of everything, because it's not as efficient if you do that. And you really do have to rethink some of these businesses.
And so you create, like, with knowing how it works, you paint a vision for, like, this is the dream of how it should work, and then work backwards until you get to a point where you're, all right, now we have the plan for how we're going to achieve that vision.
Yeah. And it's easier said than done. And I say this having done the wrong thing several times, where we go in and it's like, oh, we'll get in there, we're going to figure it out. You know, we're going to size up the team. But then you end up falling in love with the team. And it's just like, it's really hard to cut the team at that point, right? And make the tough decisions. And you hear all the nuances of like, well, this is why we never went to Shopify. You know, what about these 10 considerations, and you're going to lose these vendors, and this vendor is a friend of the CEO's. And it's just like, it's easier to do that thinking with a blank slate ahead of time. That would be my recommendation going forward. And in many of the cases, I wish we had done that. I'm thinking back to like my first turnaround was Karmaloop, where I was the CMO, and it was a fashion apparel brand. And it was very much like we got in there and then tried to figure things out, rather than, okay, let's blue sky this, you know, whatever the year was, 2010, 2011, let's figure out what this thing should look like today and then go execute on it.
You're talking about team and falling in love with the team. That sounds to me like some of that is culture. How important is culture, setting culture, understanding it?
Oh, it's everything. Culture eats strategy for breakfast, which I think Drucker said, right? So it's like, you could have a great strategy for your business, but at the end of the day, culture is what allows you to execute on that strategy. And so in many ways, setting the culture is like the first thing we can do to affect change at a company. And for me, it's always been like, I would say 9 times out of 10, you need your own management team at a turnaround. It's hard to work with the existing team. There's just so much legacy thinking. And, you know, occasionally there are exceptions. You do find the people who were part of the original brand, went, you know, into sort of like the decline with the brand and could change their thinking to try to reinvent the brand. But, you know, they're probably like 10, 20% of the of the management team and the rest, I think you almost have to bring in some outside thinking.
Did you know that most Shopify stores are leaving 10 to 20% of their revenue on the table with every single purchase? Each year, Shopify merchants make New Year's resolutions to increase profits, but they overlook one crucial aspect: maximizing every order with upsells. That's like breaking your promise on day one. But you could turn that resolution into reality with Zipify One-Click Upsell. One-Click Upsell is this secret weapon Shopify merchants are using to unlock extra revenue on every single sale. I've seen this app transform stores, doubling their revenue. In fact, One-Click Upsell has already helped merchants like you make $500 million in extra upsell revenue for your stores. Zipify OCU is the original Shopify upsell app, and it's been boosting AOV, that's average order value, since 2016, thanks to its seamless integration and intuitive upsell funnels. With the most upsell placements, AI-driven copy suggestions, and mobile-friendly designs, it's no surprise that the average OCU user increases revenue 10 to 15% as soon as they set up the app. The new year brings new opportunities, my friend. So start your 2024 strong with the app that makes your revenue goals a reality. Zipify One-Click Upsell. Go to zipify.com/Kurt and start your 30-day free trial today. That's zipify.com/KURT to try Zipify One-Click Upsell for free. Don't just make resolutions, make profits. Add Zipify One-Click Upsell today and kick off the new year with a lot more sales. A takeover like that, where you're making a lot of changes, you know, especially in the first 90 days. You got to move quickly. You want to create urgency, but you don't want people to panic and freak out. Is that inevitable? Are there ways to go about this?
I think everybody's freaking out, and you got to realize, like, everybody's probably interviewing elsewhere. Like, these are businesses that have been in decline, so they see the writing on the wall. Most of the people, the employees at these companies, know that the business has been for sale. They know that they're struggling. They know that there's a new team coming in here. So they're probably all thinking, like I would be thinking, you know, just like, hey, I don't know how long I am for this place. I'm going to go interview. That's all reasonable. And I think I just like to take it head on. I go in and I say that first day, you know, hey, like, I know this is probably your fifth ownership group and you're all worried about your jobs and this, that, and the other, but here's my plan. Here's why you should follow, you know, here's why I think you should follow me and give me a shot. But obviously it's up to you if you want to talk about it. You know, I think there are ways to handle it, but you hit the nail on the head, like addressing that, you got to get the win quickly because otherwise people sort of lose faith. So I often go in with a message of like, give me 90 days, you know, like at this point, I'm talking to the people who I want on my team for 90 days, but like, give me 90 days. We're going to try this stuff. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But, you know, you've given me 90 days.
No one wants to have to lay people off. What advice do you have for someone who's got to get to lay team members off?
A couple things. I mean, the first thing you can do is you want to make the seller do that. Like, if you're buying a company, and it's not profitable, and a big part of your thesis is I need to take costs out of that business. Like, you want the seller to take the costs out of the business first. I mean, you negotiate that as part of your package. It's like, hey, we're going to take over the business on May 1st, but that last week of April, you need to execute these cost cuts because you want that on them. You don't want it on you. And that's typical in private equity, right? But, I would say if you're inexperienced, you might not think about that and you might take over the business and then 1 or 2 weeks in realize you've got to be the bad guy, you know? But man, put it on the management team that got them into this trouble, right? That they need to take the costs out of the business. So that would be the first thing. The second thing I learned from Irv Grossbeck, who is a entrepreneurship professor at Stanford, who always would say, like, go once, go deep. It's like anytime you're going to have layoffs, it's such a traumatic thing to the business that you want to do it once. And when you're going through, you know, you go through the headcount and you're trying to figure out who you need to lay off. And to be clear, this is not a layoff for performance. This is what's called a RIF or reduction in force. It's a layoff because the business is not profitable. It's very different legally, right? It's not like these people screwed up at all. It's like, hey, we need to just cut costs because if we don't, we're going out of business. So in the case of a RIF, do it once. Be, I would say, aggressive in how deep you go, because you don't want to be in a situation where you're like, let's only cut 5% and hope that things get better, and you do it, and then 2 weeks later things haven't gotten better, and you have to do another 5%, and then 2 weeks and another 5%, because then you can't get out of that trap, and you create this culture where there's no trust. Everybody's looking for jobs somewhere else. So go once, go deep. Like if you want to cut 20%, maybe cut 25, cut. And then your message to the people who are left is like, hey, I went once, I don't intend to do this again. You know, this is now the plan to grow. We're profitable. Like, we can pay you now. Like, I think it's just like, you can be positive after that one cut.
Have you ever renegotiated people's compensation as opposed to letting them go? Is that a possibility? Does that work?
I haven't ever found that. I mean, a couple times I've seen it, you know, where it's like, hey, you're making 200K and we can only afford 100K, something like that. I've never actually successfully done that.
I think one of the tough things in business is to not become emotionally involved. And that is easier said than done. And so you want to stay detached. You want to stay emotionally detached from it as best you can. And would you agree? Do you have any advice there? Certainly you've dealt with this.
It's tough because I think the best leaders think of it almost like a puzzle. Like, they can be dispassionate. They can step back and say, I need to make these tough decisions to get this business profitable. But then on the other hand, you don't give up your humanity. And I don't want to run a business where you let people go via email, or, you know, I've seen memos or what. You got to look people in the eye and explain what's going on. And I don't think you can lose that humanity, because that's ultimately what builds up trust, and people respect that and follow you. So, no, I wouldn't. I don't know how dispassionate I've been about these things. It's hard, you know, and it's, there's no way to make it easy. And by nature, nobody wants to like cut personnel or have layoffs. It's hard, but you gotta do it. You gotta keep your eye on the big reason why you're doing it. I mean, it's just so everybody else can, so the company can survive.
In e-commerce especially, you get a lot of people who become obsessed with the idea that like everything must be data driven or tested after the fact to validate the decision. And I think it leads to scenarios where there is just like endless hand-wringing, over-analysis, over-testing. And the worse the scenario gets for the business, the more they want to lean into these things so that they don't make another dreadful decision. And I think that it could be counterproductive. Have you seen this? Have you experienced this?
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting. It's a difference between a mature, growing, successful business and a turnaround. I think at those mature businesses, you can, test all you want. I mean, it's a good situation to do that. Whereas a turnaround, you're on the clock. You need to turn around a business. Typically, you've got 90 days to do it, because, I mean, investors invest for, they invest for 3 or 5 years. But realistically, if you're not showing progress in 90 days, you are on the hot seat with the board. So I think a lot of the initial decisions you make in those first 90 days are probably half based on data, but the other half is gut instinct. Like, I don't need that many people, to run this business. Or, you know, we really, a business this size, like, should be on Shopify. Like I'm not, I know I'm, I could look, do all the analysis. It could take me like 6 months of pros and cons of trying to figure out, cost out, like what a migration project is going to cost me and the SEO impact. But at the end of the day, I know it needs to be on Shopify. I'm going to get it on Shopify. Like, let's just make that call and move on. And, you know, there's always a handful of those decisions that could make or break you as the CEO. Fortunately, I think I've gotten a lot of those right. But those things, if you get them wrong, like that's the downside. You know, that's probably your job. You made the wrong call. But, you know, there's so many big rocks in a turnaround that you don't want to get focused on the weeds. And you know, A/B testing is something I harp on. Like, look, this is just bad UI, or the site's bad, or the, you know, the product page is screwy here. Like, let's just make this change and don't tell me we need to test it, you know, because I know in my 20 years that this is a bad homepage. We're just going to do these 5 things to make it better. And yeah, if conversions go down, like it's my fault, but let's just save the time and go straight there. And we don't need to test it.
And you mentioned, you know, that this is the stuff that falls on the shoulders of the CEO. I think a lot of people with small businesses have the title CEO. To you, what is that job description? What is the CEO's purpose?
I think the CEO is the only person at the company who deals with everything outside the company. So first of all, you deal with the board. You deal with... Maybe the CFO too, but you're typically the one who's dealing with the board, with investors, strategic partnerships. I think the CEO is also the chief rainmaker. So your job is also to, you're always looking for new sources of business and often new sources of cheap customers. You can hire a growth hacker. In my experience, the growth hacker is really good at optimizing what you already have. Less good at kind of rethinking the business, knowing the industry and figuring out, you know, where, how am I going to pivot this whole thing to go fish in a new pond for customers. And then internally, you're putting the team in place. I mean, you've got the vision, you're putting your management team in place, you're getting them all aligned. So I would say it's as big picture as you can be, you know, the external, the sources of new customers, and then putting the right team in place. And those are probably the big three for a CEO.
And so with your CEO, you mentioned, you know, a strong team. You have a longtime business partner, Michael Epstein, who is the Steen. And he's CMO, right?
He was at Auto Anything. I mean, at Postpilot, we're co-CEOs, which is atypical. To have two co-CEOs, co-founders. I wouldn't recommend it. I mean, it's not like, for most people, I wouldn't recommend it. For us, it works because I've worked with the guy for 15 years. But I think in most situations, you want a unified chain of command. You want to know who is in charge, you know, because then you can't shirk responsibility. You can't say, oh, the other CEO is supposed to deal with that. Or, you know, that was Mike's job, not my job. I think in most situations, you do want one person in charge of the business. It works, again, with Mike and I, because we've been working together for so long. And in this case, it was a unique situation. We bought the business together. You know, we debated, do we want to alternate CEOs like 6 months every year? We swap. Should we do more of like the traction thing with one of us is the visionary and one of us is more the integrator? I really like that model, but you know, he's as much of a visionary for the business as I am. So it's like, we just settled on this co-CEO thing.
If you have to hire a CMO, what are you looking for?
Yeah. I mean, in a turnaround, CMOs are critical. He or she is the one who is going to really focus on that revenue line, in as much as your CFO focus on costs, right? And the two of them constantly have to be working together, one driving revenue, the other cutting costs. The CEOs in particular, at a turnaround, you're by nature lean. So you're trying to save money. You're trying to take costs out of the business. General rule of thumb is I don't like having pure managers. In other words, somebody who just whose only job is to manage other people. I like manager doers, you know, somebody who can not only manage the marketing team, but also in a pinch, build a landing page or fix a Klaviyo flow or come up with a subject line for an email. So I like to promote and sort of, I look for scrappy. I look for people who have been entrepreneurs in the past. I think people who have built a business up to 1 or 2 million in revenue and maybe tapped out and are getting burned out at running their own business. I think that's a great quality for a CMO. I mean, that was Steen. That was me with Design Public. Because they're just hungry. They get it. They can roll up their sleeves. They can do as well as manage. I think what you don't want to do is go, a lot of brands think that they're going to go get some secret sauce by getting the, you know, the Harvard or the Stanford MBA from a big company, from P&G or L'Oreal or Estee Lauder to come in. And that's going to be my CMO. And, you know, they're going to cost $300,000 a year base salary. And they're just going to sprinkle fairy dust and magic sauce all over my business. And it's going to work. But I've seen so many people waste a lot of money with that. And obviously there's exceptions out there, but those people are going to want to come in. They're going to want to build a team around them. They're used to having a lot of resources. And that's the one thing that's in short supply at a turnaround. So I would warn against that.
Friends, are you ready to level up from inventory headaches? While Shopify's tools are great to start, let's talk Finale inventory for the full journey. I got the scoop from Pauline at Finale.
Finale can tell you, you know, with reordering, sales history, sales velocity, what you're running out of, what you need to reorder, what you need to get ahead of. And then we track the digital order to the actual item received at your back door, onto your shelves and into your warehouses, to your sales channel, after it's sold, off the shelf, out of your warehouse, to the customer.
Finale isn't just an inventory management system. It's an advanced IMS that integrates seamlessly with Shopify, handling everything from purchase orders, inbound shipments, transfer orders, to giving you insights on landed costs and COGS.
When you call the team, mention unofficial 2024, and your listeners can get 20% off their first 3 months with Finale.
Take your e-commerce operations to the next level with Finale Inventory. Start with a free 2-week trial and see the difference it makes. Head over to Finale Inventory and don't forget the code unofficial2024 for your special offer. In a turnaround, we talked about switching up the team and culture and cutting expenses. But when we want to grow revenue and profit, one of the things I see people do, like either they say, all right, we've been acquired, now we increase prices, or they just go insane with discounting. And so in terms of, I mean, I assume that increasing prices is probably the preferred option here, but what, and we talked about, like, you know, testing versus you go with your gut. If it's common sense, go for it. How do you go about determining product price? Like, you know, price elasticity is a real thing there. How do you work about determining correct price?
To step back, I think you're right. Most turnarounds, if not all, in D2C have had a problem with discounting. When you look at the price in the financials, their average price, like you just see this big line item for discounts. And usually it's as the business goes into decline, the team starts to discount to try to stem the decline to get revenue up. But what they don't, it's a short game. Right, it's not a long game. What they're going to do is they're attracting customers who only want to buy on discount. And so as they go farther and farther down, more and more discounts, you're attracting more and more customers who only buy on discount. 6 months in, or a year in, you realize you're at this point where I have to discount, or no one's going to buy. So what you want to do when you acquire the business is like, okay, we got to wean the customers from discounts. We got to start. Forget about just raising prices, but we just need to charge a full margin for more of our inventory. You got to realize you can't turn on a dime. Like, you can't start day one full markup on everything, or revenue is going to go to zero, because you basically have to flush out all the old customers and replace them with new customers who will not buy on discount. And that's a long process, and it takes things like building up a little bit of a brand, you know, differentiating yourself in the market, explaining why they should buy on full discount, at full margin instead of on discount, attracting customers elsewhere, you know, take down your spin the wheel on the website and everything else that attracts like the discount shopper. So it's a lot harder than going in day one and raising prices. But one thing you can do day one is just start to do a little bit more lifecycle marketing. So if you're going to discount, reserve those discounts for the customers who truly need one to buy. You know, I mentioned the spin the wheel, like you have so many customers coming to your site right now, credit card in hand, ready to buy. And what kills me is that they see a pop-up that says like 20% off. And of course they're going to take it, but that's a hidden cost. A lot of businesses don't see. It's called a subsidy cost. The costs the business spent to acquire a customer who would have bought at full margin. Happens all the time. And so one quick way to test that is like stop with the 10, the 15, the 20% pop-up, right? Instead, maybe make that an exit pop-up, right? Give that customer time to come on and purchase at full margin before you give her 20% off, right? Another thing you could do is just like create a reason to sign up for your newsletter that's not a discount. Like, hey, we're gonna show you new fashion. We're gonna show you how to pimp out your car with these five products, you know, whatever. And then engage them via email or via direct mail. And if they don't buy, then you can start discounting again. But at least, you know, maybe widen the gap between the first experience the customer has with you and when you're starting to discount. So I guess that sort of answers your question about like pricing. Before I would even bother raising prices, I think would be throttling back on the discounts and trying to only use them when necessary.
Smart. Yeah. No, I had not thought of it that way. But yeah, the number of sites, that's just become a table stakes, it seems, like the expectation. You land on the site and it's like, all right, there's our prices, but here's the actual price you're going to pay.
Right.
And it's always that welcome pop-up.
You don't have to. Maybe you do for some, but you know, at least change it to an exit pop-up or something, right? Like there are customers who show up to your site, credit card in hand, ready to buy. They know the product. They want it. They saw it on Instagram or something. Give that person a chance to spend full margin on the product.
No, absolutely. Okay. With your experience and the fact that you are co-CEO at Postpilot, let's talk about direct mail a little bit here. Certainly direct mail, beneficial channel. How should we be, you know, in the context of a Shopify store, how should we be thinking about direct mail? It's 2024. This is still relevant?
It's still relevant, man. It's a 100-year-old channel. It's becoming more relevant because everybody's frustrated with the rising costs of Meta, for example. Rising, like there's limited Meta ad inventory. There's an increasing number of brands bidding, which just means like your costs are always going to go up. And I think smart marketers realize they want to diversify away from that. They want to build a resilient business where they can have multiple channels working, right? Not just be beholden to Meta. I would say we learned that lesson in 21 with iOS 14 that made it very hard to do Meta on, you know, brands got schwacked overnight, right? Because their Meta went to zero on mobile. So the role for direct mail is really to diversify your marketing. It's not for every brand. I would say the brand should get up there in size, probably like 3-5 million or more. It starts to be like the level where it can move the needle. And then it works a lot like email on retention. You basically want to do anything that's working on email, you could do in direct mail. You send a Black Friday campaign to previous buyers. You could flip that into direct mail. You do a win back in Klaviyo. You flip that into direct mail. And you're doing that because when you look at the data, it's a very rich audience, your previous buyers. But when you look at the data, only about 10% are actively on your list. So that leaves like 90% of your previous buyers you can't contact through email. So flip it into direct mail. Like you don't need the opt-in right? Direct mail is opt out, not opt in. And you can send campaigns to everybody. On retargeting and on prospecting, it's more like Meta. So you put a pixel on your site. Retargeting, we can correlate 30, 40% of your cold traffic to a physical address and drop a card or a catalog. So it's like high intent prospecting because the potential customer is already on your site. And then prospecting, we do lookalikes. So
you do lookalikes with mail?
You give us your best customers. We could do a lookalike just like with Meta. We do a lookalike off your best customers, come up with a brand new audience that is statistically similar to your old audience, and then you can prospect to that. So those are the core use cases for direct mail, retention, retargeting, and prospecting. There's a lot of other things you can do with it, from handwriting to driving people to store to purchase if you have a brick and mortar store. But, you know, I think it's a channel that's not going anywhere. You know, it's big, it works. It's the only channel that virtually guarantees you can contact with everybody you're mailing because deliverability is like 99%, right? So check it out.
It's pretty good. It's pretty sweet. And I think people just sleep on it because they're like, well, it's not digital. Well,
it's kind of the point. I mean, it's been hard, right? I mean, I ran, it was part of my turnaround toolkit. Like I would go into these brands and I would implement direct mail and I'd get like another 10-20% on revenue and profits within 90 days. And all I'm doing is extending whatever's working on marketing to a bigger audience, right? It's that audience that's not subscribed to my email list. I would just like expand it. But it was a pain. You'd have to find paper. You'd have to find a printer. Attribution's a big question mark. And so like, it's messy. So what we just tried to do at Postpilot, like there's the genesis of Postpilot, was we've got to make this as easy as email. It's got to be Klaviyo for postcards, you know, fast and easy. Sign up today. Your campaigns could go out tomorrow. That was just like the vision when we put it together. And I think we've got that. I think we're close. So it's a lot easier than you think. You know, we built the direct mail platform that a digital marketer would love.
I still love, and you can't use it officially, but Klaviyo for direct mail is great.
Yeah, maybe.
And there's branding people who hate that, but I don't care.
Three
words succinctly describes it.
It certainly described it for the first year when we just did retention. I mean, now we do prospecting, so I think the analogy is not really as relevant, but it's certainly like, okay, people understand it though.
So. Yeah, it gives you the idea. Okay. The time machine, the DeLorean has arrived. You go back 20 years. It is now 2004. What advice do you give Drew?
Man, I ask myself all the time because I feel like I'm having success now in my 50s that I wish, it's like, man, to just be 20 years younger. You know, that expression like youth is wasted on the young. Like it's totally true. Like if I could run businesses then, like I know now how to do things, like I would just be orders of magnitude more successful, you know? One big lesson was buy versus build. So I bought Postpilot. I learned private equity along the way. I probably would have just bought early on versus started my own thing. Because then you get customers, you get revenue. I think it's just easier to optimize an existing business than starting from scratch. You know, you can pay yourself right out of the gates, which is great. You're fast tracking 2 years of bootstrapping if you could buy a business. And then the bigger, the better. Like the bigger businesses, it's just a hell of a lot easier to optimize a business than to start something from scratch. So that'd probably be my number one piece of advice, is just to consider buying a business.
The issue is getting the money to buy the business. I think that's why we see a lot of people are like, all right, I'm going to start a business and bootstrap it. It's like, because that's the accessible, realistic thing.
Sure. But there's a lot out there on getting small business loans. And I bought Postpilot for
$50,000. Whoa.
You know, it's not, and we have 100 people now and our revenue.
Much bigger now.
The revenue's in the, you know, call it the 8-figure range after 3 years. I mean, that's an exception. Like, I don't know if it, I wouldn't, not guaranteeing that to anybody, but it's like, it didn't hurt me to buy it. It can be done.
For sure. No, that's good advice. This has all been good advice. And thank you for sharing with us. Drew Sinaki, Postpilot, where can we go to learn more about you?
Postpilot.com is where I hang out right now. Drew at Postpilot, shoot me an email. I blog there, send out a newsletter there. I'm also on LinkedIn a lot. So,
and I've got where you'll find me. Excellent. And I'll put that stuff in the show notes along with your LinkedIn. Drew, thank you so much. Always a delight.
Yeah, it was awesome. Kurt, good seeing you again. Good luck. Enjoy listening to the podcast. I could send you I think we put the turnaround tips into like a PDF that I can send you the link to.
Oh, yeah, please do. I'll put that in the show notes.
Cool. Yeah, good seeing you, man.
We'll end it there. Thanks, sir.
All right.
Crowdfunding campaigns are great. You can add social proof and urgency to your product pre-orders while reducing risk of failure. But with traditional crowdfunding platforms, you're paying high fees and giving away control, all while your campaign is lost in a sea of similar offers. It can be frustrating. That's why we built Crowdfunder, the Shopify app that turns your Shopify product pages into your own independent crowdfunding campaigns. We originally created Crowdfunder for our private clients, and it was so successful, we turned it into an app that anyone can use. Today, merchants using Crowdfunder have raised millions collectively. With Crowdfunder, you'll enjoy real-time tracking, full campaign control, and direct customer engagement. And it's part of the Built for Shopify program, so you know it's easy to use. So say goodbye to high fees and hello to successful store-based crowdfunding. Start your free trial and transform your Shopify store into a pre-order powerhouse today. Search Crowdfunder in the Shopify App Store to get started.